Hello and welcome to Sustainable Growth Out Loud, a podcast brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice, part of DC Thompson. I am your host, Julia Bottaro, and I'm here with my colleagues, Heather Dimwoody and Felicia Jackson. How are you both today?
Good, thank you very much.
Yeah, not too bad, thanks.
As ever, today we have three stories that caught our eye from the past 2 weeks. So without further ado, Felicia, please.
I should apologize on one level because this possibly isn't the biggest story that's happening in sustainability at the moment, but I think it speaks to one of the biggest challenges we face in the UK. So a report came out from Allianz talking about climate tech and how climate tech is the missing piece of the net zero puzzle. Now, this is an interesting idea because it's again talking to the concept that some kind of technological solution is going to be the silver bullet that solves climate change. I don't necessarily agree with that, but what it is a necessary part of a much bigger puzzle. We know that we need policy stability. We know that we need the right investment. We know that climate tech, and in fact, a lot of digital tech, which is going to enable monitoring and management and data analysis and impact analysis, is going to play a critical role in how we achieve net zero. The challenge is, where's the money coming from and what's driving it? In the academic world, there's a thing called the theory of change, which, you know, actually outlines the sort of causal pathway between one stage and another, you know, how you actually want to get from A to B. And one of the things we need in climate finance is an understanding of what people want. There's constant conversations from different groups about what they should be doing. So why are people investing? Is it about risk management? Is it about opportunity? Is it about the moral imperative? You know, and what are the different ways you can do it? Is it engagement? Is it divestment? What really is interesting me at the moment is trying to find a way of getting different types of finance to work together so that each of them can have a different approach. So, and what I mean by that is, if you're talking about climate tech being the missing piece of the puzzle and you're talking about an asset manager saying it needs, you know, we're talking about a market that's projected to be 600 billion in less than 7 years. Europe needs to increase its annual investments about 140 billion euros a year. And we're in a situation where the public sector is clearly struggling. You just have to think of the discussions around HS2. We have this big investment gap. It's got to come from the private sector. So what is it? Now, we talk a lot at SGV about the management of risk. And this is why companies get involved in understanding their impact, managing their impact. They want to access a lower cost of capital. They want to be able to ensure that they comply with regulation. So different investors have different needs and different interests. Even though they're not even that clear at the moment, if you think about the fact that in the UK, the pensions regulator just fined ExxonMobil for failing to publish its climate risk report on time, the pension fund. Okay, that's on one hand, it's a sign that there is greater focus from regulators on being clear about risk. But at £5,000, that fine is practically irrelevant to a pension fund the size of ExxonMobil's. And that's a pension fund that needs to be around in 30 years paying people's pensions. The markets are likely to change significantly. We're already seeing, you know, what was, Heather, you did a story a while back on the apparel market showing, was it 64 billion a year in costs in four countries alone in the textile industry?
Because it was over the course of 5 years they measured. And yeah, for four hubs, it was about, I think it was 65 billion.
There we go.
So yeah, 65 billion over the course of 5 years for four apparel production hubs.
So that is one part of the overall economy. That's a significant sum of money. That is a risk that needs to be addressed. If the way the economy works is going to change, then pension funds have to adjust to it. It suggests to me that a fine of not publishing that, and they did say it was an accident, but it's the maximum fine. So we need to have some kind of come to Jesus moment where we either take this seriously or we don't. In the UK, we've got a situation where politicians are basically pandering to the worst instincts of actually, that's really unfair. They're not pandering to the worst instincts. What they're doing is they are, in my opinion, misrepresenting the challenges we face. They are appealing to a population under attack from cost of living increases, from the energy crisis, recovering from COVID. And they're saying, we're going to cut all the green crap, and so you will have to pay less. What they're not factoring in is the way the world is changing, the way the economy is changing, the way regulation is changing. They're going to have to pay more for things in the future. And the longer we leave it to take action, the more it's going to cost. So what I really want to see is politicians, investors, scientists come together and say, how are we actually going to change the way we finance things? And it, you know, it doesn't mean forcing people to do something they wouldn't want to do, but it means putting into place a set of investors who have different interests that together might solve the problem. And that could be government and pension funds and venture capitalists. They've all got different interests, and there's all different pieces of the puzzles they can invest in. And I just think at the moment we're still taking this question of how we finance the transition into patchwork away. We don't seem to have a universal approach. And I think that's a really terrifying thing to say politically and financially and economically and socially at this stage of the 21st century.
I think there's a few points worth discussing there. So, I mean, you said they're a universal approach. I wouldn't describe it as a universal approach because, as you say, there are so many different aims, there are so many different things we want to do for so many different reasons. I would describe it as I'm going to throw the buzzwords out, but a holistic approach rather than a universal approach, because there isn't one size fits all, but there are so many things that we need to be doing. I also like that you touched on misrepresentation, because when we have so many things that we're trying to achieve for so many different reasons, it becomes really difficult to measure and assess where we are. So, I mean, we talk about climate finance as this big umbrella term, and you're like, well, what does that mean? Climate finance, is that financing adaptation, mitigation? And also, continuing the thing of misrepresentation, did you see the story today about a Civitas report that has just been retracted? Because that was really interesting.
Is this the one that was in the news last week?
Yeah, so basically, last week, Civitas, which is a kind of right-wing think tank in the UK, published a report that claimed that the net zero transition was going to cost $4.5 trillion. And that report did not hold up to scrutiny, and some of the mistakes, you know, they were pretty dramatic. So, you know, I'm talking the difference between millions and billions, and mistaking megawatts for megawatts per hour, that kind of thing. And it's basically been grossly overemphasized, and they also didn't account for all the previous reports that have said how much we could gain from a net zero transition, sort of the economic opportunities that opens up. And you just have to wonder, you know, if we don't know what we're doing or why, how are we ever going to come up with a reasonable figure that we can look at, start to break down, and start to actually deliver?
No, I think that's a really well put point. And I think I do want to be clear that when I said universal, I was actually thinking about climate finance, not finance as a whole. But again, that's even in conversation, I'm perhaps not being as clear as I should. I recognize it's really, really challenging. But I think, you know, you make the point really well about the Civitas publication, because that was picked up by the mainstream press. Then it was debunked and it was pointed out widely, mostly on social media, what the challenges with the report were. But the challenges to that report were not reported, especially by, shall we say, the more conservative press.
I should clarify that they have now published a statement saying that the report has been taken down for...
Civitas has.
Yes, yeah, they've put a statement out.
But my point is...
Yeah, but the damage is done,
this
isn't
is
it?
Exactly the point, that Civitas may have now published a retraction or saying they recognise there's errors with the report. But it's been massive news all over the country. The retraction is not the same level.
What's that phrase about a lie travelling the world before the truth has put its pants on or something?
It's boots, I think, rather than
definitely
pants.
A phrase there. Well, you know, close enough.
Let's be fair. Perhaps it was the use of the word lie is a bit strong. Possibly it's that what they did was get someone who didn't really understand the difference between megawatts and megawatt hours to write the report. And this actually brings up one of the things that Dr. Kim Schumacher is always talking about, which is greenwashing of competence. People are actually actively engaging in this market without the right background training, knowledge or information.
Now time for a break, but on this point, I think we can discuss for the story that I will talk about after the break, because it's also about building competence.
Have you been searching for the latest sustainability news, developments, insights and analysis? Why not have it delivered straight to your inbox? Census Sustainability is the weekly newsletter for individuals and organizations committed to a more sustainable future. Each issue is designed to equip your business with the tools it needs to thrive in an inclusive, sustainable economy. Join the conversation and head to sgvoice.com/signup to sign up for our newsletter.
We are back from the break, and as I anticipated, we will be talking about various things, including competence. My story is about the UK government delaying the time when the biodiversity net gain starts being enforced. Now, what is the biodiversity net gain, which we'll be calling BNG because it's easier? It's a kind of a first of its kind planning policy where if you want to build somewhere in the UK, you need to leave that piece of land 10% more biodiverse than it used to be before you started building, which is great because it's a law that looks at biodiversity. We're finally considering nature. Construction is huge. There is a lot of discussion about housing shortages in the UK, lots of construction. So it sounds like a really good development. So the rules were going to start being applied to larger companies from November 2023. And then instead of being delayed to January 2024, which is fine, I guess. It's just a bit like 2 months. I don't understand the difference that it makes. I did ask the relevant department why 2 months, and they didn't really respond. So it remains a mystery. It did cause a bit of uproar because it was initially a scoop by the BBC, and it said it wasn't clear when it would be delayed too. So there was like maybe like an afternoon where everyone kind of panics, and it was like, it's going to be delayed by a lot. It will create a lot of damage. Everyone is confused. Anyway, it's just 2 months. So I guess we have 2 more months to like deal with it. The point I was making about competence is that this law will apply to obviously land developers and construction companies, but also to the local authorities that need to go through the plans and then approve them based on the BNG. And some of them might not have the skills and competence to actually deal with this new law. So there is a bit of concern among some that they might not be well equipped. The government has put measures in place to ensure there is training, there is funding and so on. But of course, you know, this speaks to how change affects everyone. And SMEs as well, they will have to follow this law from April 2024. So no one is safe. I mean, we'll all be safer once nature is more respected.
The long-term view is this will make us safer, but I completely get the point you're trying to make, which is that while moving something back by 2 months may not sound like a big deal, what it does is support industry fear that the government's not serious, that things could change. What it does is it destabilizes the forward plan. It destabilizes investment planning. It means that those people who've been building up teams to actually work on this, they're going to be sitting around. What are they going to be doing? Companies put money into things either to build a new part of their business or to comply with a regulation. It's not rocket science. If you start messing around with the regulatory framework, no one knows what's going to happen next. And to be blunt, I do think the reason the government made this announcement, for two reasons, one of which is it went hand in hand with Sunak standing up as the man of change and cutting green action with the Conservative Party conference, and potentially in the hopes that if it gets destabilized and people aren't very clear about what's going on, they may not invest, they may not take it seriously, it may not be effective, it may cause problems, and it may cause a backlash. I mean, that might be a bit strong, but...
I don't know if you remember, a little while ago, I wrote that story about the company that had been set up to manage Scotland's deposit return scheme.
Yeah.
Because that was such a perfect example of this, where the delays and indecision of the government, and I should add that this was a conflict between the UK government and the Scottish government, but because the whole deposit return scheme was delayed, upended, this, that, and the next thing, the company responsible for managing it, which had largely been funded by private sector backers who were preparing for this new legislation, ended up going under with millions of pounds worth of debt. So that's exactly a case of companies losing out because they've invested in setting up these mechanisms so that they can comply with new regulations, and then the regulations just been fizzled out somewhere down the line. But I do think that Julia also makes a really important point about competence, because biodiversity is sort of notoriously difficult to measure. And when you're saying, you know, a 10% increase in biodiversity here from what it was before, there really does have to be some quite skillful work involved in ensuring that and measuring it and monitoring. You know, is this, what about 10 years later? What does that mean? And I wonder sort of how we find that balance between certainty of policy, meeting the urgency of these new policies, while also making sure that we have the competence to make sure that they're delivered effectively.
I think there's a couple of things that brings up for me. One of which is just the word skilled, because there's a lot of people with a lot of skills out there. What I think you're actually talking about is scientific knowledge. When it comes to biodiversity, you have to actually have people who understand how it works, what to track, what it means, the implications of changes of density of species, the implications of changes within the relevant ecosystem. That is about the science. And I think one of the things that you also mentioned that's incredibly important is this issue of certainty. Because dealing with climate change, there is always going to be this massive tension between investment desire to have a clear and stable and certain policy pathway, and science, which goes, do you know what? We have a theory. We are testing it with every single thing that we do. And every time we get proof that this thing that we have found is in line with that theory, it creates more certainty about the fact that that is correct. But scientists live in a world of uncertainty, despite what many critics might think, especially in climate science. The IPCC, which has done the reports, so they do the report of all the scientific work, and it works on a seven-year cycle. And they, when a bunch of scientists say, we're 98% certain that this is what's going to happen, that is as close as a scientist is ever going to get to saying, this is the future. So we have to find a way of managing that disconnect between the need for certainty and the reality of ongoing uncertainty. You know, people want to operate in a world where A follows B in a way that makes sense on a timetable they understand. That's just not how the world works. I don't think it ever has, and I don't think it ever will. We're constantly surrounded by change and confusion and surprise. It happens in our daily lives. Of course, it's going to happen at a macro level in an economy-wide way.
It feels like it happens every week when the UK government makes a new decision on climate policy.
Now, we're trying not to bash the current UK government. We are talking about politicians as a whole who as yet don't seem to have integrated an understanding of the economic risks that we face with the desire to get re-elected.
That's a great way to end the current segment. So we're now going to take a break.
In a world where the scarcity of key resources is starting to be felt and the impact of climate change is all too apparent, sustainable growth is no longer a choice, it is a necessity. Sustainable Growth Voice is a new online publication championing individuals and organisations that are pushing sustainable growth forward, making a positive impact on the environment, society and the economy. From innovative technologies solving sustainability challenges to social enterprises promoting inclusive growth and transformative policy initiatives, SG Voice covers the fundamental drivers at the heart of the new sustainable economy. Join the conversation that the world needs now. Visit SG Voice for knowledge, inspiration, and insight from across the sustainable growth landscape.
We are back from the break, and Heather will talk to us about the exciting world of climate litigation and insurance risk.
Thanks, Julia, for the warm, warm welcome of my story there. So, what I wanted to discuss today was basically a paper that's been published by Gallagher Rhee, where they're really looking at the threat that climate litigation poses to the insurance industry. And the report it documents some of the trends that we have been fairly well aware of. You know, we've been covering them at SG Voice from the sort of the corporate point of view, but not from the insurance perspective. So that's things like, you know, there's been a general increase in climate litigation, full stop, but also a spread in the type of cases we're seeing. So where some of the dirtier, for want of a better word, sectors such as oil and gas or agriculture, those with a really enormous footprint, they've been seeing cases directly about their emissions or their environmental destruction, that kind of thing. But in recent years, there's been a sharp increase in cases of greenwashing, essentially. So businesses misleading the public, setting targets they're not going to meet, or failing to disclose relevant information to shareholders, all that kind of thing. There's now a lot more litigation cases around those. And although there haven't really, you know, in the broad scheme of things, there haven't been that many climate litigation cases to date that have been particularly successful, but it only really takes a small number to establish the legal precedent upon which further cases can be built. So if a company has taken out insurance policies that protect them from those legal risks, so, you know, directors and officers cover or errors and omissions, then it's their insurance provider that has to bear the costs. So, you know, even if the complaint isn't successful, the defence costs alone might be really expensive. The report also warns of just sort of an increase in third-party funding. So as these cases are building, there's now law firms that are sort of actively encouraging clients to come forward with climate-related complaints. And the lines between activism and legal practice are really becoming quite blurred. So you've got all these purpose-driven law firms, you know, your Client Earths of the world, people like that. And they've got the legal knowledge, they've got the strategies, they know the tools that they need to use. And the report basically warns that lawyers are becoming more savvy and that more cases are going to start being successful. And this could come at a massive cost to insurers. So it does sort of walk through some kind of, you know, loopholes and little relief points for the insurance industry. So the fact that a lot of these cases are really about seeking change rather than seeking a massive amount of money, that's helpful if you're the one paying. And also just sort of the fact that, you know, there are loopholes in insurance policies. We all know that. So it'll be something like, you know, they've excluded pollution from their coverage or things like that. But the overall warning is that insurers and reinsurers should start reviewing their profiles and, you know, whether it's increasing premiums or just downright refusing to give insurance to people that are deemed to be at a particularly high risk of climate litigation, which then has an enormous impact on companies. Because if you can't get insurance, whether it's for a specific project or for your business as a whole, then you just cannot continue.
No, and this actually comes back full circle to what I was talking about at the top of the show, which is different sets of financial interest need to look at the problem overall and find a way of working together. Because we know fundamentally, if you are building a new project or building a new building or opening a new building, whatever it is, you need to get insurance for it. And if the insurance industry is not going to provide you with insurance, you as a company are not going to be able to do that project. You as an investor are not going to put your money in because it is at risk. Insurance is a fundamental part of the investment process. So if there is this beginning of this domino effect of the reinsurance industry saying to the insurance industry, you have to be careful. You need to not, you know, you may not, it may be too high risk to invest in companies exposed to this issue of climate change, because it's one thing, we take it for granted as, you know, carbon being a challenge for the energy sector. But every company's got emissions. You know, we're all embedded in this web of infrastructure and transportation and manufacturing and consumption. And we're all part and parcel of the same thing. And then on Julia's story, we're talking about the introduction of regulation around biodiversity and nature. It's going to go the same route as carbon emissions, only it's going to go faster because people are currently having to face the impact of what we're seeing in climate change, extreme weather. You cannot look at the floods and the droughts and the hurricanes and the tornadoes and the actual impact on economic function, on human life in the last year or so, and think things aren't going to get worse.
To me, this speaks about how there is like a behind the scenes, or what I believe is sort of a behind the scenes movement that will spur climate action. Because, you know, at the policy level, we discussed earlier, there is perhaps some confusion, some misalignment, misrepresentation in the media, and so on. And then there are these very practical, down-to-earth, everyday things like insurance, you know, that are changing. And that gives me hope, actually. Because maybe one day they will stop insuring the oil and gas development.
Well, I think it's starting.
Well, we've seen quite a bit of that, actually. Just, you know, insurers sort of coming out and saying, oh, we're not going to insure any new oil and gas or coal or whatever. And, you know, climate, I think there is a struggle, isn't there? Because the physical impacts of climate change are also a massive risk to insurers. So you've got all these extreme weather events and stuff, and you're thinking, well, you know, I do still want food producers to be able to get insurance. I would quite like to have food on my table. But, and, you know, that's a very high risk sector, obviously, you know, could get hit by, whether it's heat waves or something that could wipe out your crops. We do need to have insurance solutions for that. It's, as you say, it's that behind the scenes power of the insurance industry, is that they can develop new strategies for insuring the things that we really need, while also pulling back on that insurance of the things that are just furthering our destruction.
I do think one of the things that does need to be factored in, and this speaks to sort of politician confusion, is that one of the main reasons we, as you say, we need this insurance for agricultural producers or whoever it may be. But the point is, what this risk is saying, even before we get to a level where insurers decline to insure a project or an investment, what it means in the early days is that that insurance is going to get a lot more expensive. And in the end, that expense, that cost, is going to be fed back to the consumer, because that's how the market works. That's what I was talking about at the very beginning, of this idea that if you don't think about the implications of change over time, people are being told, let's cut the green crap now and it won't cost you as much money now. What it's not talking about is the implications for how much it's going to cost in the future. And we need to have an honest conversation about the fact that the transition is going to be challenging and it is going to cost money, but there are people working on solutions. I remember Ian Sim talking about the fact after New York Climate Week, which has just passed, that what he found really encouraging about this year was that everyone's talking about how to solve the problem. You know, that there's a real, as you say, Heather, there's a real move towards practical solutions that work within the system we have to change the way we move forward.
Well, there's also that incentive part that Julia talks about, because, you know, if you're a company and you are quite exposed to litigation, you have every incentive possible to demonstrate some risk management of that, to take action. So, you know, if you're a little bit worried that you might get in trouble for not disclosing transparently, what do? You start disclosing transparently. And, you know, even if it's just so that you can have a lower insurance premium, I don't care. You're doing it. And that is really important. And I think that's quite a positive note for us to end on today with that underground movement, because we all love an underdog, don't we?
Absolutely. On this positive note, we will say goodbye. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter and follow us on social media. And obviously, check out our website and read our incredible stories. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks so much and see you in 2 weeks.